This is Precepts Audio Message PA-260. Nathan C. Johnson, Bible Teacher. For all those who love our Lord Jesus Christ in truth.
Book of Ecclesiastes, chapter 11. So we have seen that the book of Ecclesiastes is presenting the view of life from the perspective of under the sun, which just means upon the earth. And more or less considering what is really valuable, what is really meaningful in life if you don't take life to come, if you don't take the kingdom of God into account. You just look at this life. And the conclusion of the author, whom I believe is Solomon, the conclusion of the author is that this life is meaningless. It's vanity is his term, which vanity in older English anyway just meant emptiness. And so this life is just empty. It's just like a breath. It's a puff of wind and then it's gone. So he considered that it's vanity. And the reason it's vanity, as we saw in chapter 9, is that there is one event that happens to all, the righteous and the wicked, the good and the sinner, and that is that all die. And so his conclusion is, go thy way, eat thy bread with joy, and drink thy wine with a merry heart, for God now accepteth thy works. Live joyfully with the wife whom thou lovest all the days of the life of thy vanity, which he hath given thee under the sun. For that is thy portion in this life. So he says, enjoy life, enjoy the good you have, enjoy your labor, enjoy your wife. Whatever your hand finds to do, do it with your might. There is no work, nor device, nor knowledge, nor wisdom in the grave whither thou goest. And then he looked and he saw that the race isn't necessarily to the swift or the battle to the strong or bread to the wise, because time and chance happens to all. I mean, even the fastest could injure himself. Even the strongest could be outsmarted. Even the wisest could fail to, his schemes could fail. And men are snared in evil time when it falls suddenly on them. Evil falls on men unexpectedly. And it falls on all. And he saw wisdom that seemed to him great under the sun, a little city with few men in it, and a great king came against it to besiege it. And a poor wise man in the city by his wisdom delivered the city, and yet no one remembered him. So Solomon realized that wisdom is better than strength, but the poor man's wisdom is despised. If he's not powerful, if he's not rich, if he's not influential, well, nobody listens. In spite of the fact that he's wise, his words are not heard. But the words of wise men are heard in quiet more than the cry of him who rules among fools. Wisdom is better than weapons of war, but one sinner destroys much good. Dead flies cause the ointment of the apothecary, the perfume, to send forth a stinking savor. So does a little folly him who is in reputation for wisdom and honor. And when a wise man's heart is inclined to the right hand, the fool's heart goes to the left. He goes the opposite way. And the fool lets everyone know he's about his foolishness. He saw another evil, which is folly set in great dignity, and the rich set in low place, servants on horses and princes walking on the earth. He says that's just not appropriate, but that happens sometimes. He who digs a pit will fall into it, and whoso breaks a hedge, a serpent shall bite him. Whoso removes stone shall be hurt therewith. He who cleaves wood shall be endangered by it. If the iron is blunt, and he doesn't whet or sharpen the edge, he must put two more strength. But wisdom is profitable to direct, so wisdom can help you save energy. The serpent will bite without enchantment, and a babbler is no better. Words of a wise man's mouth are gracious, but the lips of a fool will swallow himself. So we see he is exalting wisdom over many of these other things that he sees on the earth. He says, woe to thee, O land, when thy king is a child and thy prince is eaten in the morning at an inappropriate time. But blessed art thou, O land, when thy king is the son of nobles and thy prince is eaten in due season. So any land is blessed by good rulers, and poor rulers are a detriment to any land. By much slothfulness, the building decays. So he says it takes work, of course, it takes effort and energy to do the necessary things in life. He advises not to curse the king in your thought or in your bedchamber, because a bird of the air will carry the voice. So he warns, these things have a way of becoming known. So that's what we saw last time, and now we are up to chapter 11. Chapter 11 and verse 1. Cast thy bread upon the waters, for thou shalt find it after many days. Well, obviously that this is a proverb that we're supposed to get a meaning out of, because, of course, if you literally threw your bread on the water, it would get soggy and sink. So it wouldn't do you much good. Suppose if you cast a little crumb, it might float. But you wouldn't find it after many days. It'd probably get eaten by a creature or something. But the point is here, casting your bread upon the water is not to borrow a phrase from Obama, but to spread the wealth, to be generous, basically. Not have the government tax you and then give it away to people who don't work, but rather to be generous. That would be the casting your bread on the water, because you'll find it after many days. It could be that some of those that you are generous to in a time when you're in need, then they will perhaps be in a position to help you. So the idea of casting your bread upon the waters is the idea of being generous, of being generous to others, and maybe sometime in the far future, it will come back and you'll get the reward of it. And the same idea is in verse 2, where he says, give a portion to seven and also to eight, for thou knowest not what evil shall be upon the earth. And this is a common Hebrew figure of speech or idiom that Solomon uses, and many, actually quite a few other Bible authors use, where it lists two numbers like this, give a portion to seven and also to eight, denoting multiple ones or many. And Bulger points out that the phrase once and twice is used several times in Job and in the Psalms. Twice and thrice is used often in Job, Isaiah, he gives a couple examples. Three and four is used frequently, meaning frequently or many, used in Exodus and Proverbs and Amos. Four and five is used in Isaiah. Six and seven, meaning many, is used in Job. And 7 and 8 is used here and in Micah 5:5. So basically all these things are kind of an idiom meaning multiples or many. So he says, give a portion of 7 and also 8. In other words, he means give to many. It's not that you should count up and make sure you give to either 7 or 8. But no, give to many, be generous to many, for you know not what evil shall, what calamity or misfortune shall be upon the earth. And of course, when misfortune comes, if you've been generous to many, maybe one of those you've been generous to will help you. It's not that you necessarily expect that they will all help you. It could be many of those you help are still not in a position to help you. And they needed help when you helped them, and they still need help when you need help. But maybe some of them have gotten to a place where they can help you. So since you don't know what calamity might be upon the earth, be generous. And then others maybe will watch out for you if you come into a time of calamity. Then verse 3, if the clouds be full of rain, they empty themselves upon the earth. And if the tree fall toward the south or toward the north, in the place where the tree falleth, there it shall be. So he says, if you fill the clouds up with rain, well, eventually they're going to empty themselves upon the earth. The rain isn't going to stay up in the clouds forever. Eventually, they're clouds, they're rain clouds, eventually they're going to rain. And then when a tree falls, if it falls south, if it falls north, wherever it falls, there you'll find it. I mean, you won't come the next day and find it lying the other direction. Whichever direction it falls, that's where it's going to be. And the idea seems to be, in the context, is that in the same way, if you're generous, and then you come upon a time of misfortune or need, you'll expect that those clouds that you sowed, that tree that you fell, that it will be there for you in the time that you need it. Your generosity and your kindness to others will produce a crop, will produce favor for you when you have a time of misfortune. Verse 4. He that observeth the wind shall not sow, and he that regardeth the clouds shall not reap. The word for wind here is the Hebrew word ruach, which we probably know is the word for the spirit. But in later Hebrew, it also became rather common to use it for the wind. And Ecclesiastes is getting on toward later. Of course, it's quite a bit after the time of Moses. Not as late as some books. But even all the way going back to Genesis, ruach is sometimes used for the wind. It just becomes more common later. So the wind and the spirit are obviously connected because they're both invisible, and you see the effects of them, but you don't really see them working. And our spirit is connected with our breath, again, an invisible thing. So he who observes the ruach, he who observes the wind, he says, shall not sow, and he that regardeth a cloud shall not reap. So basically what he's saying is that if you're always worried, looking out, maybe you're looking for the perfect day to sow. Say, oh, it's too windy today. Well, I don't know. It looks like it might be windy tomorrow too. And you're just watching the weather. You want the perfect weather. Well, you never do get out there and sow. So busy waiting for the perfect day, you never get the job done. And he regards the cloud shall not reap. Oh, there's a couple clouds in the sky. Might be a bad day. I don't want to reap today. So in other words, you're getting so worried about these things that you're not doing it. Bullinger's note, he says, the plowing must be done when the early rains have come, even in the face of storm and tempest. Otherwise, there will be no reaping after the latter rains. So he says, if it's time to sow and you don't sow because you don't like the weather, well, then you never will get it done. Verse 5, as thou knowest not what is the way of the Spirit, nor how the bones do grow in the womb of her that was with child, even so thou knowest not the works of God who maketh all. So he says, you don't know the way of the Spirit. And again, of course, that's the Hebrew word ruach. And we had in verse 4, of course, the ruach was the wind, the storm. But here it means probably the spirit of man. It reminds me, of course, of what John, in the book of John, what the Lord Jesus Christ said to Nicodemus when he was comparing the work of the Spirit to the wind. Of course, probably going back to that, the fact that in Hebrew the ruach can mean both spirit and wind. When he told him, the wind blows where it listeth, and thou hearest the sound thereof, but canst not tell whence it cometh and whither it goeth. So is every one that is born of the Spirit. So he says, just like you can hear the sound of the wind, but you can't tell where it's coming from and where it's going to, it's the same with the Spirit. Everyone who is born of the Spirit, you don't see the Spirit entering the room in order to generate you regarding the truth, in order to show you God's truth. You don't see him. Does he come leaking in the window? Does he come pouring through the ceiling? Does he come under the doorway? No, you don't see the Spirit entering the room in order to show you God's truth. And then when he's done showing you God's truth, you don't see him leaving. You don't see him go up the chimney or out the window or whatever. So you don't see it come and you don't see it go, and yet you see the effects of it. You see the effect, and that truth is generated in a person's heart, in a person's mind. So Christ says kind of the same thing. You don't know the way of the Spirit. You don't know when that ruach comes, when he enters or when he leaves. You don't see him come to generate truth in you. All you know is that you're enlightened to God's truth. So you don't know the way of the Spirit, nor how the bones do grow in the womb of her that is with child. how does that child grow in the womb? Of course, with science now and cameras they can put in their womb and all this sort of thing, we know some more about it. But still, do any of us really know for sure how bones grow in the womb of her that is with child? It's a mysterious thing. And certainly in the days of Solomon, at least they didn't know that much about it. I don't know. We don't know everything about it today either. So he says, in the same way, even so, thou knowest not the works of God who maketh all. He says, in the same way, you don't know the works of the true God who makes everything. Just like you don't know the ways of the Spirit, and just like you don't know how the child grows in the womb, even so you don't know all God's works. Verse 6, in the morning sow thy seed, and in the evening withhold not thine hand. For thou knowest not whether shall prosper, either this or that, but whether they both shall be alike good. So if you're going to go out to sow, he says, sow in the morning and in the evening. Why? Because you don't know, will sowing in the morning be good or sowing in the evening be good? You don't know which will be better, or whether they both be the same. So if you don't know, you better do both. You better sow in the morning and sow in the evening. So it seems to be the idea, and it's kind of the same thing they say in investing, that you need to diversify. You don't just invest everything into one thing. Because if that one thing turns out to be a bad risk, well, then you'll lose all your money. But if you invest in multiple things, then if one thing turns out to be bad, then hopefully some of the others won't. It's kind of the same thing he's saying here. Sow your seed in the morning and in the evening. If you don't know which is going to be better, do both, and because you don't know. Well, that's certainly wisdom. Verse 7. Truly the light is sweet, and a pleasant thing it is for the eyes to behold the sun. So he says that the light is sweet. In other words, the light is a good thing, and we enjoy the light. It says, a pleasant thing it is for the eyes to behold the sun. And we think how nice it is on a nice sunny day, and you see the sun maybe shining through the leaves of the trees, or a bright meadow full of sunlight and so forth, sun coming in the window. It's a pleasant thing. We enjoy it. And they talk about in northern climates, like what we live in, how difficult it is for some people in the winter when there is little sun, and how people have trouble with depression when they don't see the sun, especially when there are many, many days cloudy. And then there's short sunlight besides. So it is a pleasant thing for our eyes to behold the sun. It seems that we need it even. Like I said, some people get depressed when there isn't enough sunlight. So it's a good thing to see the light and to behold the sun. But he says, verse 8, but if a man live many years and rejoice in them all, yet let him remember the days of darkness, for they shall be many. All that cometh is vanity. So he says, but if a man, if an Adam, one of Adam's race, of course this is not men in particular, but any one of Adam's race, if a man live many years and rejoice in them all, he enjoys all his years, he enjoys his life. Yet still, he says, let him remember the days of darkness, for they shall be many. So he says, you might live many years, but days of darkness, and of course by that he's referring to death, will be many. There'll be many days when you don't see the sun, when you don't see the light, when all there is darkness, the darkness of death. And those days shall be many. And we see in this a denial of the common Platonic teaching, which teaches that death isn't really death, but it's just life in another place. Well, that's not the teaching of Solomon, and that's not teaching of any of the Bible. The Bible teaches that death is a reality, and that the only way out of death is resurrection, is to receive new life. So even if you live many years and are rejoicing in all of them, still remember that the days of darkness, the days of death are coming, and those days will be many. And we realize that about 3,000 years have passed since Solomon has said this, and Solomon and all his contemporaries have been dead for most of that time. So they have indeed faced many days of darkness. Now, we don't know, of course, how long it is until the resurrection comes. And we don't know if perhaps the resurrection will, the kingdom, the start of the kingdom will come in our lifetimes. And if it doesn't, we don't know how long it'll be till it comes. It could be we won't be dead as long as we were alive before the kingdom comes. But at the same time, of course, we won't really know it. We'll be asleep in the sleep of death. So whether it's long or short, we won't know it. But those days of darkness will be many. So enjoy the days of light while you have them, he says. And then he concludes, all that comes is vanity. And that's true short of the kingdom. Everything is vanity. And if you look at our society today and the great works of our country, our nation, and our culture and so forth, and you realize, how long are these things going to last? You think of all our literature, for example, and yet, how much literature do we know that is just from the last 100 years or the last 200 years? How many of us read much that is, maybe we go back to Shakespeare, that's getting pretty old. How many of us read literature that's 1,000 years old? How many books do you read that old versus recent? Well, what's going to happen in 200 years from now? How many of the books that are common and popular now will even be read anymore? And so many things that seem so permanent, so important to us, and a few hundred years down the line, no one will even remember them or care about them. So many of these things are just vanity. Verse 9, he said, rejoice, O young man, in thy youth, and let thy heart cheer thee in the days of thy youth, and walk in the ways of thine heart and in the sight of thine eyes. But know thou that for all these things God will bring thee into judgment. So he speaks to the young man. And tells him to rejoice. And the word for young man there, Bullinger says, that means a chosen youth, implying beauty and strength. A strong, good-looking young man. So he says to the strong, good-looking young man, rejoice in your childhood. Rejoice in your young years. And let your heart cheer you in the days of your, again, it's the idea of being handsome and good-looking and strong. He says, walk in the ways of your heart and in the sight of your eyes. So what you desire in your innermost being, walk in that. What you see and enjoy, walk in that. But there's a warning involved. He's not just giving blanket permission, but he says, know thou that for all these things God will bring thee into judgment. So he says, do what you want, except know this, that God is going to judge. So you better think about that before you do certain things. And I think of the verse that says that that God will give you the desires of your heart when you really focus on him. And so what your heart wants to do should be affected by God. So walk in the ways of your heart and in the sight of your eyes, but know that God's going to judge you for all those things. So you better bring that into consideration. And the young, of course, they all think that they're going to be young forever. Seem to have that idea, or old age is something that's happened to others, but not to them. Or that their youth will stretch on for some long period of time. But we realize that that's not the case. But they tended to walk in the ways of their heart and the sight of their eyes. That's the way youth often are. But he reminds them what they can't forget, that God will bring them into judgment for all that they do. So he says, verse 10, therefore remove sorrow from thy heart and put away evil from thy flesh, for childhood and youth are vanity. So he tells them, remove sorrow from your heart. And the youth, of course, don't like too much to focus on sadness and sorrow. They enjoy pleasure and good times. Put away evil from your flesh. Don't subject yourself to anything, any calamity. No pain, no hardship. But he says childhood and youth are vanity. Now, the word youth there is shakaruth. Bollinger says it means dawn of life. Strong suggested it has to do with blackness of hair. In other words, in your young life is when your hair is black as you get old. Of course, the hair loses its color. So, dawn of life, early life, your childhood, and when your hair is still black, still dark. Well, that's vanity. That passes. Before you know it, it's gone. Chapter 12 and verse 1. Remember now thy Creator in the days of thy youth. While the evil days come not, nor the years draw nigh when thou shalt say, I have no pleasure in them. So he is still speaking to the youth, to the young person. And he says tells them to remember their Creator in the days of their youth. Bollinger points out that this is plural in Hebrew. It's the plural of majesty, the great Creator. Or it could be a reference to the plurality of God. But he says, remember your Creator in the days of youth. While you're young, remember God. And keep God in mind. Of course, remember has to do with remembrance. It's not just that you don't forget that He exists, but that you act on remembering Him. And he says to do that while the evil days come not. And again, that evil there is the Hebrew word ra'ah, which has to do with calamity or misfortune. And of course, in this case, has to do with old age. The days of old age are the unfortunate days. And then he says, nor the years draw nigh when thou shalt say, I have no pleasure in them. And when you get to the place where you are feeble and sick and suffering from constant or painful health problems, it could be you get to the place where you just say, I have no more pleasure in my days. I have no pleasure in them. So he says, it's better to remember your Creator in the pleasant days of youth before those days come. And I suppose a long life lived in memory of the Creator will strengthen one for even the evil days. But then he goes on to describe those days of calamity, those unfortunate days of old age. He says, well, the sun, or the light, or the moon, or the stars be not darkened, nor the clouds return after the rain. So he describes that during these days, the lights seem to go dark. The sun isn't as bright as it used to be. The light isn't so bright. Or the moon or the stars, they're darkened. Their light doesn't shine. Nor the clouds return after the rain. Now we realize that even the broad daylight can get dark when it's cloudy. And yet the rain is over, the clouds breaking up, and it's still dark. It's like, are the clouds back? No, it's just the eyesight has become dim. Verse 3. In the day when the keepers of the house shall tremble, and the strong men shall bow themselves, and the grinders cease because they are few, and those that look out of the windows be darkened. Well, he speaks of the day when the keepers of the house tremble, and I think the keepers of the house there are the hands. Of course, the hands are the keepers, basically, of the whole body. We protect ourselves and feed ourselves and clean ourselves. We just do almost everything with our hands. They are kind of our universal tools of our bodies. And yet, as you get to old age, the hands will tremble. You can't hold them steady like you used to. You don't have the steady hands that you had at one time. So the keepers of the house, the hands, tremble in the days of old age. And he says, and the strong men shall bow themselves. The strong men shall be bent. And the Hebrew there for the strong men is Geber, the has to do with with strength. And yet it says that the strong man shall be bent. And this probably refers to the legs. We realize that a lot of strength, a lot of power is in the legs. Of course, the legs need to be strong because they hold up the entire body. And you have a lot of strength in your legs, and yet in the days of old age, they get bowed. They're bowed down. They lose their strength. They are not so strong anymore. So the strong men shall bow themselves. And it says, and the grinders cease because they are few. And the grinders would seem to be the teeth. We realize that you chew, you kind of bite with your front teeth, but a lot of your teeth are grinders, your molars and so forth. They grind the food. And yet in old age, you cease being able to grind the food because the grinders are few. Your teeth start to fall, you start to lose teeth, or they get worn down to the point where they aren't very useful anymore. And the grinders cease grinding because they're few. That happens in old age. Of course, in our day, we have false teeth. Don't know if they had things like that back in Solomon's day, though. Then he says, and those that look out of the windows be darkened or be dimmed. Now, the windows is probably referring to the eyelids, and those who look out of the eyelids, of course, would be the eyes themselves. So, before the eyes are darkened or dimmed, of course, just like he talked about in verse 3, for the eye that the lights seem to become dim, or verse 2, I mean, the lights seem to become dim, so those that look out of the windows, the eyes are dimmed, are darkened. And then verse 4, and the doors shall be shut in the streets. When the sound of the grinding is low, and he shall rise up at the voice of the bird, and all the daughters of music shall be brought low. So the door shall be shut in the streets. Well, that would seem to be the openings. Of course, we realize our openings like our mouth and our nostrils and our ears. The door shall be shut in the streets. And if we think particularly of the ears, that the sound doesn't seem to flow, it doesn't seem to get there in like it used to. You don't hear it. The sound of the grinding is low. Now, whether that means you can't hear the sound anymore, or maybe that means the sound made by the grinding teeth is low, maybe it's back like we had in verse 3, because there aren't many teeth there. So there's not much sound of chewing going on, because there's nothing to chew with, there's nothing to grind with. Or it could mean that the hearing isn't as good as it used to be. Well, that's definitely what he means in the next phrase, and he shall rise up at the voice of the bird, or start up. Now that is probably referring to the fact that he doesn't sleep well anymore. I mean, normally you'd sleep through the voice of a bird. It's not that loud, it's not that disturbing. But the sleep is not so good, and the bird, the voice of the bird causes him to rise up. And yet at the same time that the smallest sound seems to wake him, at the same time he can't hear sounds. All the daughters of music shall be brought low. And that more should be the daughters of song. So the songs are brought low. Why? Because he can't hear them. And he's missing all kinds of pitches. And as your hearing goes, you lose some pitches before others. Well, needless to say, music is meant to hear all the pitches, all the different sounds, high and low and so forth. So the songs just don't sound like they used to. They're not as good. The tones, the mix is all off. And so the daughters of music, the daughters of song, are brought low in the old age. Then verse 5, also when they shall be afraid of that which is high, and fear shall be in the way, and the almond tree shall flourish, and the grasshopper shall be a burden, and desire shall fail, because man goeth to his long home, and the mourners go about the streets. So he speaks of being afraid of that which is high. That could be for a couple things. Number one, if you start to get pretty unsteady, your balance is not so good, well, you don't want to be going up and standing and on some ledge. some place where you could fall and tumble off of if your balance isn't as good as it used to be, if you're not as steady as it used to be. Well, suddenly heights become something that you're afraid of. And it could also be as it gets harder to walk. It gets harder to lift your legs and you kind of shuffle along. Well, if you can't really lift your legs very easily and you have to shuffle along, even like stepping up onto a curb can be a difficult thing because you have to lift your leg up to get it onto the curb. So you're afraid of that which is high. You don't want to have to climb heights. The stairs are just a daunting task to ascend stairs. So it could be because the balance is off, you're more afraid of heights, but it could also be you're afraid of having to climb heights because how difficult it becomes. And then fears shall be in the way. So you are afraid of journeying. You're afraid of difficulties in travel. And of course, the older you get, the more difficult it is to get out of the house, to travel places, the more of a burden it is to travel. And things that a youth would just skip past becomes a burden and a difficulty and a fear to the elderly. Then it says, and the almond tree shall flourish. Now that is probably not a very good translation because we're not talking about flourishing. Not many things flourish in old age. Now the almond tree seems to refer to the hair. And instead of flourishing, the word seems to be more be despised. The almond tree shall be despised. And the idea seems to be that the hair is falling out. That the almond tree is losing its almonds. It's losing its leaves. The hair is falling out. So the hair is despised. There's just not much left, and what is there isn't very impressive. So the hair is falling out. Then, and the grasshopper shall be a burden, or the locust. And realize as you get older, it can be that even what would have been considered in the past a small weight could be a burden to carry. Very difficult. Now, the word for be a burden can also have to do with being dragged. So grasshopper shall be dragged. So it could also refer to the difficulty of walking. It seems to also refer to perhaps the difficulty of lifting even the lightest weight. Then, and desire shall fail. And desire there in Hebrew, that is aviona, and it has to do with the caperberry. And the caperberry is something, they would take the caperberry and they would make kind of a dish from a condiment, and then they would eat that, and the caperberry was legendary, or it might have been truthful, that it would increase both appetite and sexual desire. So that's what caperberry was used for. So they have taken what was figurative, and they have more or less interpreted the figure in the King James, which is probably good. Because if it said the caperberry shall fail, we'd have no idea what it was talking about. So they, instead of just straight translating, they interpreted it to desire shall fail. And that's true. It could be both the appetite and the sexual desire will fail. You're just not hungry. You don't enjoy food like you used to. And sexual desire can also fail in old age. And why are all these things true? Because man goeth to his long home. Well, what's his long home? Well, it's not heaven, nor is it hell. It's talking about the grave. Man goes to the grave. He is heading that direction as he gets into all these old age and all these things happen to him. It's because he is near death. He is near the grave. As all these things are happening to him, and eventually old age passes into death. And the man, he goes, the Adam, of course, that's not just men, but women too. The Adam, he goes to his long home. And the mourners go about the streets. They go circling through the streets. And you have the funeral procession. And that's why all these things are happening, because he's near death. Verse 6, or ever the silver cord be loosed, or the golden bowl be broken, or the pitcher be broken at the fountain, or the wheel broken at the cistern. Now these all are figures for death. Or ever the silver cord be loosed. And the silver cord is the spinal cord. For the spinal cord is loosed. Now there is a superstition, and it's apparently something that is common in Hinduism, that they have this idea that man's soul is connected to God or to the Brahman or whatever it is they call God by a cord. There's a long silver cord running from man's soul to God. And so they think there's this silver cord that has to do with the soul. And unfortunately, some in Christianity have adopted that same superstition, that there's some kind of silver cord running from your soul to God, to heaven, where your soul came from. Well, that is just nonsense. And to try to quote this verse according to that superstition is just absolute foolishness. In the context of this verse, clearly this has nothing to do with a silver cord attached to your soul. And leading back to God, this is talking about the spinal cord. So it's not that your soul is loose from your body and goes back to heaven. It's that your spinal cord is loosed. It says, or the golden bowl be broken. And the golden bowl would seem to refer to the skull, the head. So before the spinal cord is loosed, or the head, skull, is broken, the golden bowl. Then, or the pitcher be broken at the fountain. And the pitcher would seem to be a reference to the heart. For the heart is broken. We realize people die from heart attacks. The heart is broken. It no longer works. So the pitcher is broken at the fountain. The heart is the fountain of the blood. It's what sends the blood throughout the body. Or the wheel broken at the cistern. Again, that's a reference to the circulatory system. The blood travels around the body, and yet in the dead, it doesn't do so. The wheel is broken at the cistern, and the circulatory system ceases to flow. So he says, before these things happen, young person, remember your Creator. Remember your Creator while you're still young. Because know all these things, this old age is coming. And finally, death. Verse 7, then shall the dust return to the earth as it was, and the spirit shall return unto God who gave it. So he says, then, when death comes, then shall the dust, and that is the soil. And that's the same word as back in Genesis, where God made man of the dust, or of the soil of the ground, and breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and man became a living soul. But when you die, that soil returns to the earth as it was. It goes back to the ground. We realize that once you die, your body deteriorates, basically breaks back down into the elements it was made of, and you go back to being dirt, basically. You go back to soil. So the soil returns to the ground, returns to the earth as it was. And the spirit shall return unto God who gave it. And spirit, again, there is the Hebrew word ruach. And the ruach returns to the God who gave it. God gave us a spirit when he breathed into the nostrils of Adam the breath of life. And our spirit comes from God. But at death, the dust returns to the ground, and the spirit returns to God, and the man comes to an end. Now this is the Bible's teaching about death. And the common teaching of the Platonists, and unfortunately many of our brothers and sisters are Platonists, not Biblicists when it comes to death. Well, they believe that death is a separation. The body is separated from the soul. And the body is what dies and goes in the ground, but the soul goes off to heaven and keeps on living, or else goes to hell and keeps on living. Of course, we're talking about heaven. But the Bible doesn't teach that death is a separation. The Bible teaches that death is a return. And the body is made of dust, returns to the earth as dust, and the spirit, which came from God, returns to God. And so the man who God made is unmade at death. He ceases to exist. He doesn't just go on living in another place. So his conclusion of all this, verse 8, vanity of vanities, saith the preacher, all is vanity. Again, vanity has to do with emptiness, with a breath, a puff of wind. And this is what the preacher says. Now, as we talked about back in chapter 1, this word preacher is the Hebrew word koheleth. And it's related to the Hebrew word kahal. And the kahal is just the Hebrew word for what in Greek we have as ekklesia, which our translators usually translate church. But of course they don't translate kahal by church because they don't want a church in the Old Testament. They want the Old Testament about Israel and the New Testament about the church. But neither one is really about the church. But the kahal is generally a marked out company. And it's often of representative leaders. And of course the convener of the kahal, the convener of the marked out company would be the leader of it. In this case, the king, King Solomon. He is the convener of the koheleth. If Israel's body of leaders is going to gather together, it would be because Solomon convened them. He is the leader of all of them. So he is the koheleth. So the koheleth speaks and says, vanity of vanity, all is vanity, all is emptiness. And the reason is because all is heading toward death. We're all heading toward death. And so all these things that seem so important in life, in the long run, are just vanity. They all end up in the grave. And the man with all his experiences and all the good and the bad that he went through and all the things that he learned, all that he gathered in this life, just goes back. His body goes back to dust, the spirit goes back to God, and it's all been empty. It's all been a puff of wind. Verse 9. And moreover, because the preacher was wise, he still taught the people knowledge. Yea, he gave good heed and sought out and set in order many proverbs. So he says, moreover, because the koheleth was wise. And of course, the koheleth in this case was very wise. This was Solomon, the wisest man in the Bible, of course, next to the Lord Jesus Christ. So the koheleth was wise, so he still taught the people knowledge. And we see Solomon doing that. We see people coming from nations far away to come to Solomon and to learn his wisdom. So he taught the people knowledge, and he gave good heed and sought out and set in order many proverbs. And this we recognize here describing Solomon's career. He gave heed, he paid attention to things, and he sought out more knowledge. And from the knowledge and the wisdom that he gained, he set in order many proverbs. And we have some of those proverbs here in the book of Ecclesiastes. We have some of those proverbs in the book of Proverbs, along with some of the knowledge Solomon collected and got from his teachers. I don't think Solomon is the exclusive author of the book of Proverbs. I think there are some of Solomon's teachers and the wisdom that he taught and gathered is in there as well. But Solomon also set in order many proverbs, the koheleth. Verse 10, the preacher sought to find out acceptable words, and that which was written was upright, even words of truth. So the preacher, again, it's the koheleth, the convener of the kahal, he sought to find out acceptable words. He was trying to find words that would be acceptable, and of course they're acceptable because they're true, they're accurate. And then it says, that which was written was upright, words of truth. So this is the book's own answer to those who say that this book is just an inspired record of man's faulty reasoning. Is that the book itself testifies that what is written in it is upright in words of truth. And it's true that death is a return. It's true that a live dog is better than a dead lion. It's true that there is no knowledge or wisdom in Sheol where we're going. It's true that the dead are in darkness. So those who try to deny the message of the book because they want to hang on to their Platonic theories, they would have to deny this verse, which claims that this book is as much the words of truth as any other part of the Bible. It's upright and it's words of truth. So I don't believe for a moment that this book is inaccurate, that it's faulty. It's a record of inspired record of man's faulty reasoning. I believe that this book is the word of God and it's the truth. Verse 11, The words of the wise are as goads, and as nails fastened by the masters of assemblies, which are given from one shepherd. So the words of the wise, in this book, it is an example of the words of the wise, along, of course, with Proverbs. And, of course, really all the words of the Bible are wisdom, but this is some of what we call wisdom literature, which is a type of literature. The book of Ecclesiastes is wisdom literature. It contains the words of the wise, words of wisdom and Proverbs and so forth. So it says, the words of the wise are as goads. And a goad, as we probably know, it was generally a sharp pointed stick they would use to poke the oxen to get them to walk forward, to plow the field and so forth. And they get it to work and would want to stop and rest and graze or whatever. It would not want to plow the field, but you use the goad to keep it moving. So the words of wise can act as goads, goading you on to do what you should. We've talked about the slothfulness. Through slothfulness, the roof falls in and leaks. And all the words of the wise can be as goads to get you to take care of your roof and so forth. And goad you on to do what you should do. And then the words of the wise are as nails fastened. Now, Bullinger suggests that nails in that part of the world were built into the wall, because eastern walls were too hard or too soft for them to be hammered in. Of course, we have walls where it's easy to hammer nails in. He says, well, they actually built the nails into the wall because you couldn't hammer them in because the wall wasn't of the right hardness to do that. So the words of the wise are like nails fastened into the wall, or like hooks in the wall. You have a hook in the wall and you can... There's the old expression in English, that's something you can hang your hat on, meaning that's something you can depend on. And the words of the wise are something you can hang your hat on. Then, by the masters of assemblies. Now, I don't know what it would possibly tell us to know that masters of assemblies were the ones who had fastened nails in the wall. But I think the point here is that the words of the wise are masters of assemblies. They are lords. The word there is actually Baal, which is in the Old Testament often used for a bunch of false gods, but it really means masters. The words of the wise are masters over assemblies. They teach assemblies, they teach rulers how to rule, the words of the wise do. And of course, all rulers have generally had their counselors, their advisors, and they hope for words of wisdom that will be masters of them, that will guide them in what they should do. Then he says, which are given from one shepherd. And true words of wisdom come from a single shepherd. And who is that shepherd? Well, it's the good shepherd. It's the Lord Jesus Christ. It's God himself. He gives the true words of wisdom. And as we look at the book of Proverbs, and Proverbs talks about wisdom, personifies wisdom, well, I think wisdom is personified in Jesus Christ. Verse 12, and further, by these, my son, be admonished. Of making many books, there is no end. And much study is a weariness of the flesh. So beyond these things, he says, he talks to his son and he tells him to be admonished. And admonishment often has to do with admonishing someone as to what they should do, as to how they should act. He says, be admonished, my son, by these words of wisdom. Now, this phrase, my son, it could mean a literal son. Solomon's thinking of his son, but it also is used often as address of a teacher to a student. So he tells his son to be admonished, those who are learning from his words. Then he says, of making many books, there is no end. And much study is a weariness of the flesh. And this is true. It seems that of the making of the books, there's no end. I talked about as time goes on, books are written, and sometimes we can go back and read very, very early books like Herodotus or Homer or some of the Virgil, some of the early works. But if we think of all the books that were written at the time, and the books from that time that have survived, is probably very few. It seems that there are more and more and more books being written. And there's just no end of it. And he says, and much study is a weariness of the flesh. And it's true, if you study for a long time, you get tired. Studying can be hard work. Thinking is hard work. And studying can wear you out. Now we'll take the weariness, especially when it comes to studying the Word of God, studying the truth. We'll take the weariness. And I don't think we get tired of it. It can tire us out. Maybe we need a rest. But then I think we come right back to it because we want to know the truth of God. But much study can be a weariness. And Solomon, in much of his study, which was not necessarily focused on God, but gathering knowledge, he learned of the weariness to the flesh that study can be. It can tire you out to study. So then he says, rather than study some more, because much study is a weariness of the flesh, let's go on to our conclusion. So verse 13, let us hear the conclusion of the whole matter. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the whole duty of man. So he goes on to the conclusion. So this is the end of his book, his conclusion of the whole matter. That word matter could be the conclusion of the whole thing, or the conclusion of all this speaking, of all these words. So he said all these things. What's the conclusion? What's the bottom line? Well, the bottom line, the conclusion, he says, is fear God. In Hebrew, it's Eth HaElohim. Fear the God. Fear the true God. Fear the Creator. And he says, keep his commandments. And the word there is the Hebrew word mitzvah. And maybe better translated, precepts. Fear God and keep his precepts. Keep his rules for life. Live as he would tell you to live. And this is not a reference to the Ten Commandments. This is the reference to God's laws of life, the way he would say to live. Keep those things. He says, for this is the whole duty of man. And there again is Adam. Any one of Adam's races, it's their duty to fear, to reverence, to respect God, and keep all his precepts, to live the way he says to live. That's our duty. That's the whole of man. Verse 14, for God shall bring every work into judgment with every secret thing, whether it be good or whether it be evil. So he says, the reason you should fear God and keep his commandments is that he is going to bring every work into judgment. And here's the thing, is that the things of this world might be fleeting, they might be transitory, they might be a breath, a puff of wind. But at the same time, there is ultimate importance to many things that happen in this life. God doesn't go giving us his commandments, his precepts, his way of living, because it doesn't matter how we live. You might say, my life is just a breath anyway. Why would I have to live according to God's rules? Why would I have to live God's way? And the answer is that God gives significance. God does give significance. And God is going to judge the actions done in this world. And when your actions done in this world are brought into judgment by God, suddenly they're not just puffs of wind anymore. Suddenly they're the means by which God is going to decide your eternal destiny, whether it's going to be life or whether it's going to be death. And if it's going to be life, what kind of life is it going to be? Is it going to be a life of honor or a life of shame? A life where God will highly exalt you, or a life where you're just barely escape with your life, escape by the skin of your teeth with no honor, with no glory, just your life as a prey. As your only consolation is that you get to live. So God is going to bring every work into judgment. So that means the things that we do are significant, not because this world is significant, but because God is going to bring things into judgment. He's going to do it with every secret, with every hidden thing. You might think you hide your actions from God. Maybe you hide your actions from the world. Maybe you do some wicked thing and quote-unquote get away with it. Nobody ever finds out. No one ever knows. But God is going to bring into judgment every hidden thing. So ultimately, you don't get away with things if you manage to hide them from men, because God will bring every secret, every hidden thing into judgment. And that'll be whether it be good or whether it be evil. Now, sometimes it's not just evil things that are hidden, but good things are hidden. Sometimes people never know or acknowledge the good things. Some good things are done in secret, some good things are done anonymously. And no praise or acknowledgement ever comes back to the one who does them. But God will bring both the good and the calamity causing, the evil things, into judgment. So therefore this life and the things that are done in this life matter, because God will bring them into judgment. But that also leads us on to the conclusion, well, he judges them, and then what? Well, then there's another life to come, if he judges you worthy of it. So we see that the ultimate value of everything is in life to come. And as Bullinger points out, this Ecclesiastes that gives the emptiness of this life, yeah, the solution of it is in 1 Corinthians 15, which is the resurrection. Resurrection is what gives meaning to this life and the things done in it. Paul says, if in this life only we have hope in Christ, we are of all men most miserable. But it's not in this life only we have hope in Christ. So the things we do for Christ, even if they pass away and are forgotten, and the people we do them for are breaths of wind that disappear, well, still there is a resurrection. There's a life to come when these works will be brought into judgment. And then we'll find that both the good works and the evil works are significant in relationship to the life to come. So that's the book of Ecclesiastes. And the book of Ecclesiastes should teach us the very important lesson that nothing in this life really matters without God, and nothing in this life really matters without the kingdom of God to come, without the next life. And often in this life, when we're surrounded by this life, when we're in the middle of it, when we're swimming through it like a fish swimming through water, the things of this life and of this world can seem so important to us, and things that really have little meaning can seem very meaningful. When we take the perspective, when we realize death is coming, and everything that we do and gather and accomplish is heading toward death, well, then we can get a better perspective on it. We can see that it's God who gives meaning to everything. Nothing is meaningful without him. But that with God, some things are very meaningful, the reason being that they will come into judgment and they will affect our lives to come. So that the value and the meaning and the importance of things is all dependent upon God, and all dependent upon that life he's going to give us in the future. Sometimes we'd like to think that honesty is always the best policy, but sometimes dishonesty gets people ahead. And yet in view of the life to come, not so. Sometimes you do good works and we get no benefit from them. Sometimes you serve God and all we seem to get is trouble and heartache for it. But in the light of the life to come, that's not the case. If we're trying to find our hope and our ultimate reward in this life, we're going to be disappointed. Because the ultimate end of this life is just old age and death. So our hope has to be in the life to come. And that's the important lesson of Ecclesiastes. And it's not man's faulty reasoning, it's the truth. And it's the truth we need to accept and believe.